You're exactly right. I did get a lot more than I thought, but you know, every time I thought I was getting beaten with a rubber hose or some sort of mistreatment, I kept coming back to, well, isn't this what Americans would want me to keep doing? Isn't this what I signed up for? I didn't join to serve the government. I didn't join to serve the military. I joined to serve my fellow Americans. I said, hey, I can do this job better than the average bear, and I'm offering myself to do it. And the military powers and the government powers said, yes, you can. But then when I started doing the job and doing it well, and they saw I wasn't playing their game, they saw I wasn't playing part of the lies and participating in the financial shenanigans and the intelligence corruption, then they jettisoned me. But, you know, I came in it as a duty as an officer and a duty as an American to my fellow Americans and to my fellow military members. And my philosophy is to attack, attack, attack. I do not stop. I do not retreat. And I'm not here to win friends, and I'm not here to lose friends, but I am all about the truth and nothing but the truth, because I know that's what we are suffering a loss of in this country. And we see it every day with this Jade Helm operation, with this ISIS, with this Islamic counterterrorism war for the past decade. Everything has been based on lies and half-truths, and I'm hoping more Americans will just be encouraged and stand up and start to advance in this direction in their own communities.
Yeah, exactly. I want to reference something that's on your website. You give a very stark and stern warning. In the event of my untimely death, then you go on ... that you'll release key and pertinent information that some people won't want out there. In other words, you're buying your own safety. So I want to make this point from the very beginning with our audience. This is deadly serious material, pun intended.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I discovered an incredible trove of documents and financial accounts and information from a Swiss banker quite accidentally. And upon discovering it and being given copies of the files and the documents and the names and everything about them, I quickly disseminated them to key people that I knew that were friendly and lawyers that I knew and some of which were hidden under rocks and fields, because I knew if anything happened to me, this needed to get out. And it was also an important insurance policy to put out, not because I love life or love the material things of life. But I'm not a fool, but I'm more than prepared to die in a mission and a cause. That's why I put on the uniform. But I will not go in a haphazard or lazy or stupid manner. But I quickly made copies of everything that I had been given and discovered, and that's why I think one of the big reasons that I've been sort of left alone, and I've had some disparagement and some attacks, but they don't dare stir up the hornet's nest because they know all of the stuff that is safely compartmented away. And it's just now breaking the surface, and it's really going to break the surface in the next 30 days or 30 to 60 to 90 days when the courts re-examine all the evidence that has taken 2 years to get in front of a court and all the witnesses are subpoenaed. This is the first time in the history of the 9/11 saga, all of this is going to come out. And I didn't plan to put myself here. I just found myself at the center of the web, connected to all the scoundrels and usual suspects. Dov Zakheim, Brad Birkenfeld, Union Bank of Switzerland, Booz Allen Hamilton, Edward Snowden, Julian Assange. All of these people and entities and parties and organizations are directly connected to me. And I mean, I look at my resume and my past as sort of a divine hand of God guiding me along this path to do a duty, to be a speaker of truth. Because where I found myself working and what I was doing at the highest levels of counterterrorism, the State Department, the highest levels of Special Operations Command, at the highest levels of U.S. Central Command, you really couldn't make up. And it was a phenomenal, phenomenal experience. But it's not over yet.
Well, let's start with a particular issue in hand that you've blown the whistle on. Take us where you will and say, this is really where I discovered everything wasn't as I expected it to be.
Well, the whistleblowing adventure was quite unexpected. In a nutshell, I found myself introduced to the Swiss banker, Brad Birkenfeld, who had come over from Switzerland after being targeted by the Central Intelligence Agency, which Edward Snowden was involved with as a CIA NSA analyst. And Brad was put into a prison, and he was prosecuted by Lanny Brewer and Eric Holder, who had previously worked for a firm called Covington & Burling, which represented Union Bank of Switzerland. And I've written all this up on my website and book, which you can, you know, Google and pull up, called Shell Game. And it goes into great detail, and it takes at least 3 hours to sort of really get a lot of it out. But Brad Birkenfeld had 19,000 bank accounts that he had brought forth, and he was thrown in prison. He was covered up. He was prevented by Senator Carl Levin and the Senate Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations. Carl Levin was also on the Armed Services Committee. He was prevented from sharing his information with the military terrorist finance operations. Now, that struck me because I worked in that capacity. That was my job as a financial analyst, was tracking the money, the banks, the hawalas, the money laundering operations, the networks, the couriers. Everybody that had a dollar that was given it to terrorists, my job was to track them, find them, profile them for destruction, for targeted drone strikes or for special operations assassination operations. So when I met Birkenfeld, it was like the goose that laid the golden egg. And I immediately told him, well, I can't believe that I found you in a federal prison. And we immediately started reports and sent them up to the military, General James Mattis, Congress, everybody in Congress, over 150 congressmen and senators, got a copy of my military whistleblowing report, which analyzed Birkenfeld, his experience, his materials, his contacts, the accounts, the Saudi donors and the Kuwaiti and the Qatari donors who had bank accounts that were also tied to Rudy Giuliani and the Oil for Food program. I mean, it's a multi-layered shell game. And I didn't title it with all this in mind. It just sort of haphazardly is perfectly coming together. The title fits the whole story ideally. But Birkenfeld gives me all this information, and then we start channeling it up. And the next thing you know is when he gets out of prison, 1 month later, he's paid $104 million on September 11th, 2012. And since then, he's gone underground and been absolutely quiet. And now he's trying to get a presidential pardon, and he's now speaking to the French intelligence sources, and there's a conference down in Miami that he's going to be speaking on. And I have been following all these organizations to make sure that they are also addressing the military component of his Swiss banks, to track down the military dimensions, where this money is going that's hurting and killing and maiming U.S. military personnel and contractors. But nobody wants to talk about that because it's wrapped up in the whole artificiality of ISIS, the whole CIA-Mossad contractor relationship that exists within ISIS, the whole Al-Qaeda operation being, of course, a CIA-Mossad fruit with Saudi participants and the Wahhabi participants. So everything I was doing in the State Department Special Operations Command suddenly came into focus when I discovered Birkenfeld and the Swiss bank accounts.
That's telling what you just said about ISIS. Our understanding of ISIS from a public point of view was, first of all, they're a hybrid of other terrorist organizations, and they received their military equipment from abandoned American military equipment, which I know from growing up in a military family. That's a huge no-no. Battlefield commanders cannot do that. You can be court-martialed for that.
That's
Let's
right.
talk about ISIS for a minute. How does this enter into your knowledge of what this government should not be involved in but is?
Well, there's two ways to look at their whole track record. Either we are the most incompetent, bumbling Keystone cops wearing a military uniform who have been lobotomized and have no business wearing the uniform, no business in the military, because it is absolute stupidity, as you've just wisely said, to leave all that equipment, all that ordnance, all that ammunition, everything behind, and they've now left all that for bad guys to use, or it was done intentionally. And if it was done intentionally, what was the goal? What was the operation? Well, it was to empower a bunch of contractors and Wahhabi radicals and idealists to pursue a black flag operation to carve out a section of the whole Middle East and call it the what you currently have, the Islamic State. But all the whole policy goal has been was to weaken a lot of these institutions and governments for the past 25 years. Libya has been weakened and then destroyed. Egypt was weakened with the intent of destroying them, but suddenly the military coup returned and all the Islamic Brotherhood guys were thrown in prison. Iraq, severely weakened, and Syria is the next one where a lot of ex-military guys have said if Syria goes the way of the ISIS Wahhabis, then Europe is going to go through a total police state because they're going to start penetrating the European fields.
And well, Scott, let me stop you there just for a second because I wanted to ask you. When I first looked at ISIS and what they were doing, on a map you could see they were headed into Syria. Then we had this humane, I don't know what you call her, almost a missionary girl from Prescott, Arizona, who was killed by ISIS, and President Obama says, we're going in there after them. We're going to put boots on the ground. Now, if we chase ISIS into Syria, Russia's already told us they're going to attack us if we go into Syria militarily. What's that all about?
Well, of course. I mean, look at Russia. Russia has been taunted and poked and grenades thrown at it, and a coup d'etat structured by the CIA is suddenly overthrown the previous government from when was it last October, November, December, that whole change. For the last year, it's been a civil war, and it's all been orchestrated by the United States using the NATO cover flag. And that is not in the American people's best interest. What that's caused is Russia to start militarily tightening up and getting prepared and saying, you know, you will not cross a certain line. We will not be subjugated. We will not become a vassal U.S. state. And when you read a lot of the literature and the public relations and the statements from a lot of the Russian high diplomats and Putin himself, they say it very clearly that they're very respectful, but they're also mad as hell. And they're not going to be pushed or weakened or corrupted. They're going to stand up. And part of the expression of them standing up is they're making key military relationships and ties with China and with Iran and with Syria and the BRICS nation economic establishment is now starting, I think, to dwarf the U.S. petrodollar organization that was previously structured over the last 30 years. So there's some very significant plate tectonic shifts in economics and military strength. I think my forecast has always been that the Europeans are going to come along the side of the Russians and the Chinese because it's in their national interests. It's in their economic.
I agree with that. I agree. I look for Germany to leave NATO and align with Russia because of natural gas, banking interests.
Yeah.
And, you know, Canada's talking about going to the AIIB bank with China.
Yeah, I think they're all looking for a way to sort of bow out and politely say, you know, we've had a nice evening, we've had a nice date, but I'm going to go and go out with this other suitor now. And, you know, it was fun, we had our laughs, but, you know, it's time to end this. And yes, we'll still be friends, but we're not in love with you. Okay, I think that is the general spirit that's going to be coming over the European mind because the European, you have to be European and come from Europe to really understand some of the simplicity yet complexity behind the European identity. And the identity of Europe is more tied to Russia than it is the United States at this stage. They've got thousands of years of culture from Scandinavia to Eastern Europe to Germany, Italy, France to Scotland, Ireland, the United Kingdom. They're all sort of the big partridge family, right? And I don't say that flippantly. I say it because I was born in Scotland And my dad was a Marine Corps aviator in Vietnam. He was an American. My mother was Scottish. But I came from sort of both sides, and I've seen it very clearly. And I just get a sense that this natural evolution of economic policy, of social policy, of military policy, the European, especially the youth of Europe is much more libertarian. They're not the hard left. They're sort of the center right, but they've been bruised and battered by this 10 years of war. And they haven't really suffered too many internal attacks. The Charlie Hebdo, there's been a lot of reports that that was an internal false flag operation that was trying to gear them towards the Patriot police state that the U.S. has been inclining towards.
I think it backfired on them.
I think it did, too. I agree with you. It did backfire. And I think that backfire was one of many backfires that you're going to see increasingly making sounds. And the U.S. is going to be sort of increasingly isolated because our arrogance and hubris have put our policymakers into a mindset that, you know, well, you're either with us or you're with the terrorists.
Yeah,
well, that doesn't apply. That's not a smart way of trying to define yourself. Well, you're either with us in the petrodollar or you're not. Well, you're either with us in our artificially genetically engineered foods or you're not. And all of the choices that the U.S. starts to put on the table are increasingly dysfunctional or unattractive. So where are the Europeans going to go? The dysfunctional, unattractive policy choices? Or are they going to go towards more of the Russian-Chinese policy choices, which I think are going to be increasingly attractive and increasingly healthy?
Well, and that leaves us isolated, basically, doesn't it?
Well, I think we are. I think we, and I don't say it with any sort of positivity or gratitude. I'm brokenhearted about this because I come from the Reagan days when Reagan was president. I mean, that was my formative years of youth when I was in high school, and America was the shining city on the hill. America was the beacon of salt and light. America was truth. Yes, we had our failures. Yes, we did some things that were, you know, skullduggerous and scandalous, but, you know, it was also the time of the Cold War, right? So Reagan had us geared up for the Cold War. However, after 1990, everything should have taken a much different shift. We should have went out of our way to make Russia our best friend, as close to us as the United Kingdom was and is. Instead, we attack, we isolate, we start to try and crumble the city, the country from within. And you'll see, again, in a lot of the political talks from Putin and the hierarchy, they look at that with a lot of resentment, a lot of animosity.
That's why we're seeing what we're seeing today. We're going to step aside for some messages, Scott. We come back, we'll pick it up right here. We'll also go back into the ISIS topic and get your opinion on where this is going.
Dave Hodges is as mad as hell, and he's not going to take it anymore. This is The Common Sense Show with Dave Hodges.
Scott Bennett is our guest, Army Special Operations, PSYOPS Division, and a whole lot more. The biography of Scott is up on the website. We'll be linking to his website in his books. And Scott, time can get away when we're talking about heated topics like this. So while we're all calm in the moment coming out of the break, let's tell everyone how they can follow your work and how they can get a copy of your book. And we'll revisit this again before the end of the interview.
Well, the easiest way is just go to Google and type in Shell Game by Scott Bennett, and that'll pop up, and it'll take you to the website. The website is www.armypsyop, that's spelled ARMYPSYOP, .wix.com/Scott Bennett. And there's also a Facebook page on there, but just Google Shell Game by Scott Bennett, and it'll bring it up, or go to armypsyop.wix.com/Scott Bennett. You'll find me.
Okay, and Wix is W-I-X. And like I said, I'll link to that on the show description. We'll post the interview tomorrow for everyone's benefit, and we will link into Scott's website as well. Scott, as we went into the break, you were talking about how after the fall of the Soviet Union, you know, and I agree with you. We should have done a mini Marshall Plan when it came to the breakup of the republics, and we could turn them into great trading partners and so forth. Why do you think we didn't?
Well, you know, it saddens me to say, but honestly, I'm always honest. I speak the truth as it feels to me, and I expect that from people. But honestly, I think the reason is from 1990 on, we have been pursuing a sort of a godless government policy in this country. Political correctness went absolutely out of control, and with Bush Sr., the father, who I have all sorts of funny business with him in Panama and financial shenanigans. And
right.
I could go on and on about the money and the gold that Bush Sr. was tapped into. And I know a general from the Philippines who took that, who was thrown in prison after he was given the instruction to take a lot of that money out of the Philippines, out of airports and things like that. There was a lot of dirtiness from 1990 onward, and there was a lot of, I think, a psychological, you know, problem that there was such animosity towards the Russians, and a lot of it was based on religion, to be honest with you. There was a hardcore Catholic school of thought within the U.S. Department of Defense and the Pentagon, the intelligence agencies, and within, Congress that hated the Russian Orthodox. And the Russian Orthodox and the Catholic Church had a big schism, as everyone knows, and some of our American policymakers couldn't let that go. And it's not been existent within the Protestant or Presbyterian or Methodist or any of the Protestant circles. They've not had that animosity towards the Russian Orthodox. And that sort of took over our policy area of advance. You know, in military terms, you have an axis of advance, and we seem to be driving forward to weaken and destroy and take apart piece by piece, country by country, out of the Russian orbit. And it's, you know, from 1990 until 2015, you can look at all of these little operations that were based on growing the U.S. hegemony. And the Russians have said this in all of their policy papers and all of their speeches. They basically said NATO has been strangling us more and more and more, and putting missile shields here and bases there. And that's why you have an 90% approval rating of Putin among Russian citizens. And I think it's like 86% anger at the United States among Russian citizens. So we've sort of done it to ourselves. Now, that doesn't mean we can't do a turnaround. That doesn't mean we can't go, you know what, we've had a moment of clarity. We've had a come to Jesus moment and said, wait a minute, we're going too fast and going in some wrong directions. Let's see how we can contain terrorism, how we can stop terrorist attacks within our country and within our allies. And to do that, we have to work closely with Russia and China, and not be trying to go it alone.
That's a very telling answer, because to pursue that course would have made the most sense unless you hearken back to Dwight Eisenhower's farewell address, in which he said, beware of the military-industrial complex. I mean, the only thing I can think of that makes any sense here is we're pushing towards war because it'll make money for somebody.
Well, that's the other sad surprise, like the clown coming out of the tin box that I was met with when I was in the Bush administration. I joined the Bush administration to not get a job, not to, you know, advance my ego or vanity in the political circles or try and, you know, do anything for myself. I joined the political world to serve my country, to advance what I thought was healthy conservative principles relating to family and marriage and economics and military, you know, military might. I didn't have a neoconservative agenda to conquer the world. That's just crazy. But I did have a view of our country, you know, needed to be taken back to the healthier days of, you know, the Ronald Reagan era. And I suddenly found myself in the Bush administration, which was, in a lot of ways, it was nothing to what I thought it was. I thought it was going to be much more conservative, and it was drastically not. It ran counter to a lot of the family and conservative policies and beliefs that most Americans have. And then I found myself, after serving the Bush administration, being taken up into Booz Allen Hamilton, one of the biggest defense contractors in the world. Now, I had done a lot of academic work and theory work and writing and work for various, you know, government agencies. So I'd become an expert in the Islamic psychological mind, the Islamic identity, the Islamic myth and culture and history and traditions. And my background had been in advertising, so I knew how to target messaging to the Islamic mind. So that naturally inclined me into the military world of psychological warfare. So Booz Allen Hamilton had contacted me through one of their top generals, a guy named General Jeff Jones, who was basically the Merlin of psychological warfare. He was renowned as, quote, the father of modern PSYOP. And he had been around for a long, long time and written a lot. And he had contacted me and said, you know, Scott Bennett, I like you. I like your writing. I like your attitude. Because he saw me sort of dress down Donald Rumsfeld and General Myers at a Pentagon meeting one time. And I had that videotaped, and I had stood up and made some questions on PSYOP to General Myers and Donald Rumsfeld. And General Jones liked how I did that. It was fearless. It was bold. I wasn't looking to make their friendship. I didn't have any care what they thought. I just hit them with the truth. And they agreed with my premise. So, that's when Colonel Jones contacted me and brought me aboard Booz Allen Hamilton. And he said, you're going to be developing psychological warfare theories. You're going to be developing, all sorts of platforms for winning the war. And we need creative people to step in and enhance the bureaucratic mind that runs the military right now. So he was a kindred spirit. So I jumped into Booz Allen Hamilton thinking I was going to do some really great work, and I did. But the problem was the defense contractor really didn't want to win the war. It was like, okay, well, all we need to do is throw this pass, we'll score a touchdown, we'll win the game. All we need to do is throw this big bucket of water on this fire and it'll go out. But Booz Allen Hamilton didn't want that. They wanted to keep the fire going. They wanted to keep the game going endlessly. And that struck me as a moral compromise, to say the least. And the cost was guys getting killed, kids going to war and wearing uniforms and getting maimed and crippled and blown up by this never-ending war. But I found that at State Department. I found that at Special Operations Command. I hadn't even gone into the 9/11 issues. I never even discovered a lot of that material and the research and the experts that were behind it until well after 2010, 2011. But I discovered all this sort of accidentally in Booz Allen Hamilton. And when I was down at U.S. Central Command, tracking the money sources, tracking the money supplies and the banks and the couriers and the wealthy donors and the governments that were involved, and I can't go into a lot of those operations, but I kept going into my work like a fight, like a war we're trying to win, and I kept finding guys trying to stop me, trying to say, well, we're not going to do that without a new contract. We're not going to do that without more money. And I'm saying to myself, how can you not do this? How can you not give this commander this material? He's asking us for this. We can do it. Let's do it for them. No, we're not doing anything more until we revise our contract and this and that. And it was the most disgusting thing I encountered. Now, I ran counter to that instruction. I was delicate and diplomatic, but I didn't obey a lot of that instruction. I found ways to get my recommendations and research into the hands of commanders. But it was soon after I started doing that that my boss, Dov Zakheim, who you might know from being the Pentagon comptroller who lost $2.3 trillion, Dov Zakheim.
Right, I should say right before 9/11.
Yeah. Dov Zakheim was the comptroller right before 9/11 who had, quote, misplaced $2.3 trillion as well as sold a lot of armaments to Israel. He's a rabbi, Dov Zakheim. He's got a dual citizenship with Israel. And he was the man who was right in deep with the Pentagon, where the auditors were. He had a whole team of Army auditors tracking this money down, which was the part of the Pentagon that was incidentally hit So it was quite bizarre that the room that all these Army auditors were in that were tracking the money supply that had gone missing were all killed. And one of them was not, and it was funny, he was put in charge of some part of the 9/11 commission, I remember. So the more I started digging into this, I found some real ugly stuff. But not to digress, but Dov Zakheim was my boss down at U.S. Central Command. And when I think when he started really seeing my temperament, what I was doing, where my allegiance was, which was to the American people and the military mission, not to the defense contractor, not to this whole scam of 9/11. That's when he fired me. That's when they orchestrated a false paperwork error on my military housing form and turned it into a federal charge and prosecuted me with it and threw me into a federal prison. Dov Zakheim was directly connected. He was my boss. He hired me and he fired me, and he was directly connected with the whole Pentagon 9/11 issue, as well as the SPS, the plane remote control systems, as well as buying 767s and converting them into tankers and selling them to foreign governments. I mean, there's all sorts of really smelly stuff that you just know there's something not right there.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about Zakheim for a second. Dual citizenship with Israel. This has in part led to many people approaching me and telling me that Mossad was also involved in 9/11. What's your opinion on that?
Well, I would say absolutely. There's been some wonderful experts that I think are brilliant in their analysis of the Mossad involvement. I know for a fact, I mean, Booz Allen Hamilton had a lot of Mossad agents in it. Booz Allen Hamilton had an entire floor in its McLean, Virginia headquarters and its Reston headquarters where it had top secret documents stored. So a government contractor has top secret documents from the United States government stored inside of a civilian building. And you've got Mossad operatives inside as defense contractors. So basically they have access to all of the top secret documents that their contractors can pull out of the federal agencies that they're assigned to. That's how it works. So Scott Ricard is a great analyst who has a lot of intel and experience with some of that material. I know I've talked to Kevin Barrett and Ken O'Keefe and Susan Lindauer and Barbara Honegger and Rebecca Roth and Alan Zabrowski and, of course, Richard Gage. I mean, a lot of these guys I've come to know and just shared my piece of the puzzle. And they've all confirmed, yeah, there was a heavy Mossad involvement in 9/11, heavy Mossad involvement in Booz Allen Hamilton. And I saw it up close and personal. Now,
when you look at the Mossad involvement in 9/11, just to look back, what makes sense to me is they wanted to make us angry enough that we would do their dirty work in the Middle East.
Well, they certainly took it from the template they designed in the 1960s, right, when they bombed the USS Liberty, the ship that was out away from Egypt, and the Israeli fighter craft came and strafed it and blew it up and tried to kill everybody on board, knowing that it was an American ship. And the only reason they didn't get away with it is because sailors survived. And of course, McNamara and Lyndon Johnson tried to cover it up, tried to turn away the rescue U.S. military forces. But that was a tragedy, and that was the first example of Israel and the Mossad trying to pull in the U.S. and destroying one of their ships, pretending that it was done by a bunch of Egyptians. And, you know, they got caught. And that was covered up a lot, I think, by the U.S. media, which has really changed since, I'd say, the late 60s, 70s. Probably 1975, 1980 was when the media in the U.S. really started taking a hard turn for the Mossad Israeli Christian Zionist sort of impulse to give all sorts of green flags to Israel for whatever their policy choices were. and covering up a lot of the, you know, human damage capital that may have, you know, occurred as a result of some of their military operations. But the USS Liberty was a first. Scott Ricard has some good material on the Israeli strategy in the 1980s, where their objective was to weaken all of the surrounding governments so that they'd be, you know, less of a threat and more easily, you know, tapped into their resources and things like that.
Arab Spring.
Early version of Arab Spring. That's right. That's exactly right. And you don't see Israel being overtaken by ISIS. You don't see videotapes of them pounding and going in and making claims about destroying the, you know, the Israeli Jewish presence there, because they're given aid and comfort in hospitalization by some of the Israeli operations. So the media never really talks about it. But those are the facts. You start bringing the pieces of the puzzle together, and you see very clearly their fingerprints, their involvement, their tactic of trying to bring in the U.S. using false flag operations. They try to do it in France. Everyone knows who watches the video of that terrorist leaping over the French police officer after he shoots him knows it was a blank because there was no skull or bones or blood that came out the other side of the guy's head when he was supposedly shot. And I know from military, when you're shot with a 7.62 weapon, you don't have much of a head left. It's easy for most Americans to kind of let that go. They don't see it. They don't really pay attention. They just digest what they're fed. But the people who listen to your show, for example, I know probably have high IQs, very well informed. They read, they're not swayed, and they sense the writing on the wall that this whole thing has been engineered. It's been a false flag operation.
Well, I clearly think it is. What's your opinion since we've gone down this rabbit hole of 9/11? What happened to Building 7?
I'm sorry. I'm not the expert, of course, in 9/11, but I do know from the material that I've gleaned and analyzed in this that it had documentation from the Enron and some of the big financial cases that were being analyzed. I know that there was stock options that had been placed back in the 1990s that were supposed to come to fruition and be paid back on September 11th or 12th. That were totally canceled and destroyed as a result of that building going down. And I think that involved a lot of Russian money that was going to be owed to Russia. They had a whole bond scam. And I saw a little bit of that at the Heritage Foundation. They had a similar operation with Iraqi dinars. And this whole financial manipulation is very apparent in a lot of these conquest operations. But Building 7 was detonated with internal explosives. I mean, anybody mm-hmm. with a brain who can do the physics analysis and look at it carefully and then complement that with some of the camera timing issues with the BBC recording the building falling after 20 minutes after their reporter had already said it fell. And Building 7 coming down in a straight line from a fire, and the key is, of course, all the architects and engineers and scientists who live and breathe concrete and steel and architectural designs, all of whom are saying with absolute fearless integrity, this was not, and it was physically impossible, according to the laws of the universe, for this building to have come down in the way the official story tries to explain it. It's impossible, and it's an insult to people's intelligence, and it's even worse than that. It's treason. It's covering up of murder. Everyone should know that it was absolutely a false flag, and it was an engineer. Now, you walk away after discovering the what happened, the buildings being exploded and the thermite and all the other molten metal and things like that. That's an easy one. Yeah, it was destroyed purposely. It wasn't done by planes. It was done by explosives and things like that. But then you walk away with why? Who did it and why? And then the Americans should be saying, well, you know what? I shouldn't have to figure that out. My congressman and senator was elected to figure that out. He's in the key position. He's got the authority to contact the government agencies that do this investigation. He's got the authority to walk into the Pentagon and demand an explanation from generals and military brass with top secret clearances. My congressman and my senator are in the position to investigate and report all that. But sadly and obscenely and absolutely treasonously, not one of them has done a single thing in this whole area. And I saw that personally when I reported to congressmen and senators that I discovered Swiss bank accounts and the Swiss banker who related to me and all of the Saudi Middle Eastern donors that were involved with using Swiss banks to fund terrorism. I reported what I knew and how it came to me, asking for debriefing, asking for the Senate and the Congress and the military to meet with me and meet with Birkenfeld and get all this on the table, because it had never been done. None of Birkenfeld's materials had ever been allowed to be seen by military authorities. And you know what? Not one congressman, not one senator, not one military official ever contacted me or debriefed me or contacted Birkenfeld and debriefed him. And that is the greatest act of treason that I can imagine, because that report went out September 25th, 2012. And since that date, how many kids have been killed? How many kids have lost their legs, lost their eyes, lost their faces, are in hospital beds as vegetables? How many mothers and fathers have no son or daughter anymore, or have a child that's just in a coma on a hospital bed? All because they've been killed either by ordnance, by a bomb, or by a bullet, or just in a helicopter crash. Because none of this stuff was ever analyzed. And none of these terrorist financing accounts from Switzerland have ever been stopped, have ever been turned off, have ever been reverse tracked. None of them. No one's done anything. The only senator who did a little bit was Rand Paul. Rand Paul wrote me three letters, very timid, very plain vanilla, instructing me to contact Pennsylvania congressmen and senators, which I did. They never responded. But Rand Paul was the only one who made at least a gesture of involvement. Now, I will come back to Rand Paul, as I will come back to every senator and congressman on the Hill, and I will depose them. And I will pull them into court. At least I'll make an effort. Whether they allow it or not, that's another story. But I'm going to go like David going against Goliath. And every letter and every report is going to be like a stone slung at their foreheads. And I'm going to make it public. I'm going to record it on video and audio and advertise it to as many alternative radio and TV shows as I can to say, here is my interaction with these members of Congress and these members of the media. And these military people.
I'm sorry to interrupt, Scott, but we got to step away for our top of the hour break. We come back. We're going to pick it up here. I keep promising we'll return to ISIS. We will. Stay tuned, everybody. We'll see you on the other side. Welcome to hour number two, and you are indeed listening to The Common Sense Show, and we come to you live every Sunday evening at this time from 9 p.m. in the Central Time Zone all the way up to midnight. And don't forget, Annie will be joining us for the last half hour with her rendition of the news that you won't see on Fox or CNN. Certainly not on CNN. And just preceding Annie in the third hour will be Katie Whalen, our health reporter, in which we'll be unveiling a lot of things that mainstream medicine doesn't want you to know about either. So you'll want to stay tuned for that last hour. Our present guest is Scott Bennett. If you've just joined us, we've just had a riveting first hour. We've explored a lot of different topics with his experience in Army Special Forces and PSYOPs work. And Scott, I want to go back to one thing and close a loop here on 9/11. As you were speaking, and you talked about the sensitive corporate documents that were destroyed with Building 7's collapse, I couldn't help but draw the parallel to what happened, you said, with Zakheim's key people and their records and the $2 trillion overspend at the Pentagon.
Yeah, yeah.
It just goes to show you that a false flag attack certainly has more than one objective. But this is the question I want to lead into because, you know, we out here in the media get our stuff, you know, from sources such as yourself, and you're probably one of the most credible sources I'll ever talk to that has insight into how these things work. If the Mossad was involved, and I agree, they had clear motive to be involved, who on this side was helping them?
Well, you've got some good documentaries and research that have already been developed that warrant an examination that deals exactly with that question and exactly with those people. And the foundation of the analysis is those who have dual Israeli-U.S. citizenship in the political, military circles and the media, of course, circles and the defense contractor circles. And you come with Pearl and Wolfowitz and Dov Zakheim, of course.
What about Chertoff?
Chertoff. Oh, yeah. Chertoff is an interesting character because he shuttled away the Saudi family right after 9/11, as you recall. And then he was also in the Department of, well, he was in the Department of Justice at that time. He then went, well, Department of Homeland Security, and now he is at Covington and Burling. So, Chertoff is now at the firm that represented Unibank of Switzerland and all sorts of other international European banks. Chertoff now works for them. And that's a fascinating little leapfrog path he's taken. And it also applies to Lanny Breuer. Lanny Breuer went to Covington Burling for the Department of Justice. You've got Eric Holder now working for J.P. Morgan Chase, which was also involved. So you've got a lot of the Israeli dual American citizens in the high levels of government that, quite frankly, I think is unconstitutional. You can't serve two masters. And how anybody can allow that law to exist without challenging it as unconstitutional is beyond me. That's one of the first things that should be brought up in a challenge, is that you cannot have a dual citizenship. You are either a citizen of the United States of America and prepared to serve when you're called to serve in a draft, or you are a member of another country. Because theoretically and technically, if there was a draft of sorts, these high-level dual citizens could simply go to their other country with all sorts of, you know, valuable intelligence. So that law is very bizarre how it's been allowed to sneak under the door. But you've got the dual citizenship issue, the split loyalty, not even to open up the Pandora's box of Netanyahu and the other Israeli prime minister at the time of 9/11, both being from the military branch that dealt with assassination and special operations. Uh, saying on the very day the buildings fell that they knew it was Al-Qaeda, they knew it was Islamic terrorism, they knew it was the Muslims, they knew it was Osama bin Laden, and now they needed to go on the war path. And that is, I mean, completely suspect and should be outright an indication of lies, and it should have been investigated on September 12th, 2001. But it's taken this long for people like yourself and the alternative media and architects and engineers and all of these experts who finally started to bring all this out. And they haven't done it for lack of effort. It's because they've been blocked and stopped and prosecuted and silenced by U.S. government officials and military officials and the media. But now I think we're at a critical stage where the snowball has gotten so big and the momentum so strong that the American public are going to naturally, more and more open their eyes and discover this. So I think we're on the verge of a renaissance of intelligence information pertaining to 9/11 and the false flags. And Ken O'Keefe is a great talker on this material too.
Well, what I've noticed, and first of all, I want to congratulate you for coming out in the open with this. But you're right about a renaissance of information. I've been a lightning rod since I started covering Jade Helm. I've been approached by a Texas Ranger, by a brother of a Texas Ranger, both saying the same thing independently of each other, which in Texas, by the way, they say they're bracing for an ISIS series of incursions. I've been approached by high-level military, by a DEA agent. You know, it doesn't end with the people who are coming to me, because even people on the other side are afraid of what's coming.
The Jade Helm thing is a very interesting topic, because you open a door for something that's fascinating. I had a discussion with John Wells on Caravan to Midnight on Jade Helm, and we both were in agreement that if you have an ISIS camp in Mexico and the Mexicans know about it, they're not going to be there for long. The Mexicans are ferocious killers of anything alien in their country they don't like. And they include Central Americans and South Americans in that. They are Mexicans and Mexicans only. So this notion that the Islamics could set up a operation in Mexico is asinine. They do have something that may be there that's an American-sponsored, an American-paid, and a CIA-Mossad operation that may be down there that's being tolerated, that's being paid for in millions of dollars in black budgets. That's a different entity altogether. But and if it is that, if it is down there under permission of the U.S. government, permission of the Mexican government, then there's another indication of the whole false flag ideology. Right. Now, there are a lot of American military people who are standing up and looking at the Jade Helm operation and going to follow it. They're going to be on them like white on rice, and they're going to be tracking them. And I'm happy to hear from Rangers and Special Forces and SEALs and PSYOP guys who are saying, we are going to be down there and watching exactly who's where and what they're doing, and basically being the shadow of any operations that are going on, because this is simply a first stage scouting operation. If it's a federal military operation in states, this is simply to target the American citizen groups that may be problems, that may be disagreeable, whether it's white right-wing militia or anarchists or whatever. They're going to be targeting them, looking at their geography, their real estate, for eventual policing or incarceration.
Well, yeah, Scott, let me throw this in. I ran a video on my website, and this ran commonly. We have dissident extraction drill on tape from March 27th in Fort Lauderdale, with great detail that I won't go into, but the detail was stunning. And there's no question of what we're looking at. And then we've got the Jade Helm personnel. When they go and talk to these communities, they say, well, we want to put people in, by stealth infiltration, is one way it was expressed in the Houston Chronicle. And they said, then we want you to play the role as a community of see something, say something if we're not blending in. And they're using special forces for this. And I think you're right on the money. It's citizen political dissident extraction drills. And then they're listing Texas and Utah as hostile states, which I find deeply offensive that our government would basically wage war on the American people, even if it's only in a drill. So this is, and let me take this one step further, and then I want you to respond to this. ISIS in the Judicial Watch document, and that, and I've heard an interview with my friend Rory over on SGT where he interviewed the judicial, one of the Judicial Watch lawyers. This document's solid. It's double sourced. They link ISIS to the drug cartels, and I'm sure you're aware of this too, Scott. Going back to 2007, and again in the Tucson Police Department memo in 2010, they both say that the drug cartels in Mexico are linked to Hamas and Hezbollah. So should we really be surprised that ISIS is camped out 8 miles from El Paso?
Oh, no, not at all. I mean, I know firsthand the drug operations and the CIA-Mossad involvement. It's been there for 50 years. That's one of their major financial mechanisms, how they generate cash and they recruit. I mean, no, one of the discoveries I made in this whole sojourn was I discovered the U.S. Department of Justice is teaching, and you can't make this up, but I can send you the documents. It's in my book, but the U.S. Department is teaching inmates in federal halfway houses when they come out of prison that CIA and Mossad have been running drug operations for the last 50 years. The syllabus of this class is called Deep Black. And I discovered it when I was accidentally put into a halfway house. Most of these guys who were put in a halfway house have been in jail for 30 years. And I went in there sort of accidentally. But I was sort of, I found myself in this class and they force you to attend it. And this Department of Justice figure is walking around discussing this syllabus written by David Guyatt called Deep Black. And it was a whole analysis on the CIA Mossad drug operations, killing U.S. military personnel who interfered, killing journalists. I think they came out with some movie over this past summer. And that's a reality. They're really teaching that. And if you look at the news, there's a story that came out the last couple of days where a citizen militia in Texas stopped a couple of guys crossing the border and had a truck full of cocaine. And the guys said they worked for the CIA. Well, that's just a supportive story to the Deep Black prisons class that they're teaching and the reality.
Deep Black class, who are they teaching it to specifically?
They're teaching it to inmates who are coming out of federal prison that are re-entering society. They have to go through a halfway house first. And they're also teaching similar things in prison. But when you come into the halfway house, you're supposed to be going back into the community. Well, this is a class called Deep Black, in which they go through a syllabus of material that was written by David Guyatt, G-U-Y-A-T-T, and I can send it to you, or if you look on the website, I think I've got it in one of my blogs called Deep Black. And this tells inmates, now think about this, these guys have been in jail for 25, 30 years. They've been in jail because of drugs. They're violent, you know, kind of guys who can't spell cap. They haven't got much of an education, but they've been in prison because of, most of them, for drug offenses. And now they're being told by the Department of Justice in an apologetic way that, well, you know, you all have to be aware of the true drug operations are being conducted by the CIA Mossad. And here's how and here's what they're doing. And, you know, you just have to get along and get on board and know that this is going on. And they sort of are trying to cultivate, I think, an anarchy, a rebelliousness, a sort of a.
Okay, I was going to ask you to what purpose.
And that's the only purpose that I can glean is that they're trying to stir up animosity and violence. And it makes sense when you look at what happens in Baltimore or what happens in these parts of the country where they, you know, kill a black guy. And suddenly you've got all these people stirring up the hornet's nest, pissed off. Well, a lot of these guys have probably been through that class and it's just pouring gasoline on their animosity, their fire. So no one knows about that. I was the first one who's ever exposed it, and I sent it to the Florida court as a motion stating that Because they were trying to say I needed to go through, you know, a sort of a drug class or this and that, which was ridiculous. And I wrote the court and said, I do not, because I've just gone through this class. And by the way, it's saying the CIA has been instrumental in this. So I'm asking the court to investigate it, because either they're telling me lies or they're telling me the truth. And if they're telling me the truth, then the court needs to recognize that the Department of Justice is now exposing the Central Intelligence Agency working with Mossad, a foreign intelligence agency, and doing illegal drug operations. Mm-hmm. So you're telling
us... I've got something that supports what you're talking about, and unfortunately, I don't have all the details in front of me, but I wrote an article last summer based on what a DEA informant gave me, and what basically was testified to in federal court in Chicago by a Sinaloa drug cartel member had been captured, said, you can't bring charges against me because we have an agreement with the DEA to allow in 80% of all drug shipments.
Yeah.
And I was supposed to be one of the 80%, not the 20% you're allowed to bust. So that ties hand in hand with what you're talking about. And I think the trump card to what you're talking about, Iran-Contra.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Iran-Contra, and also one of the key points was Puerto Rico, a place called Coronet Oaks. Coronet Oaks, Puerto Rico, one of the central hubs for all CIA drug operations that was, I mean, brought in. And, of course, some of the other material that we're familiar with is the Bill Clinton, Arkansas connection. But it's all there. And it's just staggering because it's interesting because I found myself in a legal position where I can introduce it into a court of law. And if I can introduce it into a court of law, then I have standing. And if I have standing, then I can exploit that standing into a civil case as well as a criminal case. And I'm the only one in the country that really has that position because of what they did, because of where they sent me. And it's sort of like, okay, you know, you own the dog. Now you're going to be responsible for the mud it gets tracked. When it comes back with mud on its feet and it walks across the carpet, it's in plain view. You can't cover it up. You know, it's right there. And that's what I am. I went through the mud. I went through, you know, 2 years of prison in Pennsylvania. And then I went through this deep black class. And now I'm coming back to the court saying, you had no right to do this. You violated my rights as a military officer. You violated every single military officer's rights by doing this to me. You violated posse comitatus. You took a military administrative issue, and the military already said there was no crime, and you've handed it over to the Department of Justice, and they prosecuted a paperwork error and turned it into a federal crime, and you then put the guy in prison for 2 years. Susan Lindauer has a very similar story. But we're the living examples of citizens who've gone through this Nazi prison state that all Americans really need to sit down, listen to us, meet us, listen to the material, read it, and say, wow, if they can do it to them, they can do it to my son. They can do it to my daughter. They can do it to my husband or wife. And that's the moment of decision. Are you going to really become educated and take this material and put it in front of your church groups or any of your, you know, community organizations, your veterans groups, or any of these community groups that have sort of a responsibility to address this, or are you going to keep your head stuck in the sand? And I think the people who listen to your show are much more activist-oriented.
Well, they are. They are. In fact, I'm going to throw you a real quick bone and let you respond to it when we come out of the break. But I've been able to double-source this. ISIS to Sinaloa here in Mexico. Sinaloa is connected to Hamas and Hezbollah, who in turn, all these groups are receiving drugs and arms from the Sanchez Paredes. Who are they? The largest drug cartel in the world, basically run by the Peruvian army. And who are their connections? Well, again, Hamas, Hezbollah, all the hybrids that are making up ISIS in the Middle East. I've been able to trace this. I was walked through this step by step last summer when I was exploring the immigration crisis, not even along the lines of what we're talking about tonight, Scott, but just immigration crisis. I had a DEA agent meet with me and say, this is how it is. 1, 2, 3, 4. And their last three prominent people assigned to the DEA office in Peru have been fired for trying to interfere with the Sanchez Paredes and the flow of weapons to these groups in Mexico, as well as drugs.
Yeah.
Do you have any knowledge of the Sanchez Paredes?
I don't. Not of that group or that operation. I just know in general the similar weapon transfer and empowerment of some of these gang operations or quasi contractor CIA operations. That justifies their whole budget for a lot of the police, law enforcement, FBI intelligence operations. They wouldn't exist without a threat, and they inflate the threat. And that's what I saw as a defense contractor. They took a threat, that was really a campfire and turned it into a forest inferno. And it shouldn't be that way because in reality, it's not. I mean, the Muslim countries and personalities, they are not looking to penetrate Baltimore or the Midwest and get all sorts of violent overthrow or uprisings or Sharia takeovers or any of that crusade-oriented emotionalism. That's not their agenda. That's not their reality. They're more inclined to simply carving out their own Islamic idea and state. And they're all different. All these countries are very, very different, and they don't look at the Wahhabist view as very attractive. It's only Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Qatar, Bahrain, and now Libya. I mean, Libya was a little bit more stable before. Now you've got a bunch of savages running around going apeshit crazy. And that's been the repercussions of the whole Middle East military policy is stirring them up. And
at the heart of it is going to be ISIS. We're going to step aside for our bottom of the hour break. We come back, we'll continue with Scott Bennett. I understand that we're under attack. Live streams and some other aspects of our broadcast. Someone doesn't want this message to go out. Stay tuned, everybody. If you're hearing us, we'll make contact with you on the other side. Anyway, I want to get back into the CIA, ISIS, Mossad situation. As you look at this thing unfolding and knowing that they were armed with American military equipment illegally and irresponsibly left behind, ISIS clearly will get us into Syria, but in your estimation, why the presence in North America? Could it be false flag attack? Let's talk about that.
Well, I would probably say it is going to be false flag because the strategic goal of such an operation has absolutely no benefit to the Muslim community, to the Muslim identity. There's absolutely not a single thing that could be gained or cultivated as positive by any Islamic operation in the United States. Every American instantly would turn against the Islamic personality. They would burn down every mosque that they could find. Every state in this country is its own individual country. They try and call it a federation. They try and call it a United States of America. But let's be realistic. We all know we're from California, or we're from Arkansas, or we're from Alaska, or we're from Texas, or we're from Idaho, or wherever we may spawn. We love our state and our community and our local, families and the culture and the lore and the myth of our own, where we grew up, where we spawned. We don't have a love necessarily for the entire United States idea. Of course we do in one sense, but we have more of an intimate love with the local community and people and culture that we came out of. And that's the strength of America, as de Tocqueville said. So any Islamic operation would come up against that tidal wave that would be absolutely destructive. So that leads me to believe that, of course, no sane Muslim militant operation would be conducted. They operate through soft power, through winning hearts and minds, and by attracting, not repelling, not threatening. The ISIS operation is different, but the recruitment is significantly different. So if that's not the case, then it has to be a false flag. The false flag has much more victory because they do what they did under 9/11. They trigger a police state operation. They trigger military forces to violate posse comitatus. They basically authorize military movements and control. And the thing about Jade Helm is it's a joint interagency group operation. Now, I worked in the interagency. I know exactly what that means. It means SEALs and Special Forces and PSYOP guys work hand in hand with the Department of Agriculture, the Department of Energy, the Department of State, your local state political institutions, your governor's office. You're going to have all of those agencies working in tandem with the military. The military is, you know, the point of the spear, but the interagency special operatives, those are the ones who are pretending to be librarians or pretending to be meter maids or pretending to be, you know, guys walking around taking census counts. That's who are going to be doing the intelligence absorption, who are going to be looking at, well, where are the churches and let's go and where are the veterans meetings and where are the veterans of foreign wars and the foreign legion and the Vietnam veterans groups? Where are all the potential problems and where are the high schools? And they'll be doing a slow tentacle infection and just to see how well they can do it, with the goal being that they ultimately want to, you know, have more of a draconian police state power influence. And the only way to do it is through fear. You saw it in the Boston Marathon issue, and you see it with, of course, the Pentagon attacks and the World Trade Center attacks, all of which, the more and more material I start seeing coming out from reputable sources indicates that those are, you know, false flags designed to intimidate and scare people who already don't have a lot of time to give analysis to this material. You know, they work 9 to 5 and they come home and watch The Simpsons and drink their beer, their glass of wine. They eat a little food, play with their kids for half an hour and go to bed to start it all over again. Your people who are doing this show and the people who listen to this show are the cream of the crop. They're the top, you know, 2% of this country, I'd say. Now, the hope, of course, is the 2% can change the 98% because they're more intelligent, they're more aggressive, they're more connected. But this whole Jade Helm ISIS nexus, I think, is being designed to move military deeper into civil society and find the trigger fear points within civil society. Now, what the media will do with it, that's yet to be said. I think they're already losing a lot of the market share with the American audience. So you may have more and more mainstream media people questioning this, but they may not. They may completely come down to the side of the Goebbels propaganda machine, where you'll be the only voice, you know, left to stand, Dave.
That's a bad place to be. Just ask Michael Hastings.
Well, you know, that's funny you mentioned him, because Michael Hastings got a copy of my report that included all of the material on Swiss banks and Birkenfeld and the military dimensions. He got all of that material, and I think it was within a couple months he was taken out by a tree that attacked his car and burned the engine for an hour or so, like a thermite charge. But yeah, Michael Hastings got a copy of it. And Michael Isikoff and Tom Hamburger of the Washington Post. So Michael Isikoff from NBC News was given a 2-hour briefing on all the material that Birkenfeld and I had developed, and he didn't report a single thing. Neither did Tom Hamburger. James Mattis was fired within a month after getting our letter, and Michael Hastings was killed. Now, that doesn't deter me, because I have no fear of death, and I'd rather die a glorious battle than a, you know, whimpering slavery to materialism and being bought off with $104 million. I just won't accept it. I will rather go down in a charge of glory than you know, a slavery to a bunch of liars. But some of these guys have been sacrificed.
Any idea what else Michael Hastings had? I mean, the totality of why he was killed. In fact, I'll throw something at you I've been told, and I don't know if it's true. When he was killed, he was allegedly going to the Israeli consulate.
Well, he was pulling in material linking Brennan, CIA director Brennan, to Special Operations McChrystal. He had already done a report on PSYOP, and I think he saw my PSYOP connection as a deeper level of what he'd already studied. In his going to the Israeli, any Israeli entity, ambassador or consulate or things like that, I don't know if he was naive, because that was probably what instantly set them off to target him. I know I had military Pentagon guys come up to me and say he'd been killed with a thermite charge. So it's pretty common knowledge that he was killed by a military-grade weapon.
When you say thermite, a bomb in the car, a drone strike, what do you think it was?
I heard it was a drone strike or some sort of strike. I've been told it was a remote control takeover of the vehicle, and it was struck. Just the video that was taken too shows it was a thermite explosion. But I'm not the technical expert. It could have been a little bit of both. But the bottom line is, it was a military grade weapon. It was a weapon system that targeted him. So then you ask, well, why was he targeted? What was he working on? And then you begin to draw the constellation of all the people he was targeting. He was targeting Brennan, and Brennan was mentioned in my report on 2012. Brennan and a whole list of characters that were connected to the Birkenfeld operation. And it was a 2 months after that Snowden went public and left the country. And Snowden worked for Booz Allen Hamilton, my company. He worked with the same guys that I worked with and knew in Hawaii. And I think when he saw me and saw my report, that was one of the things that sent him over the edge. And Glenn Greenwald reported some of Snowden's material. He hasn't reported all of it, but one of the most damning was when Snowden reported that his turning point was when he saw a Swiss banker targeted with a false DUI, and the CIA came in and got him out of prison. Well, that Swiss banker was Brad Birkenfeld. And Brad told me exactly that story, as well as a variety of other guys. So it was bizarre. You couldn't make it up. You could not make this up. But it's absolutely there in black and white. The documentation trail exists.
Well, what you're confirming for me, Scott, is something I know, but I'm just getting a different flavor.
Yeah.
We live under a mafia. This is no different than they wear suits and stand for the Pledge of Allegiance, but this is the mafia.
Yeah. Yeah. Sad. It's very sad, but true. It's a, there's a book written on the intelligence agencies and the top secret America, I think it was called. Those people who have top secret clearances and work in the in Washington, they all, you've got about 1 million people, and that is the Platonic pyramid. You've got the philosopher priests, the enforcers, and the peasants. All of us are expected to be peasants. The enforcers are the military police and the FBI and the CIA and that whole crowd. And then the philosopher kings at the top are these congressmen and these high-level criminals, as you wisely identified.
Well, I just want to make a program note here. I've heard or reading here from a lot of people writing in, and I'm sorry I can't answer all of you as I'm trying to pay attention to my guests, but it looks like making the shift to phone has worked. So that's good. I've got a lot of confirmation of people listening on phone. But to other people who were cut out and you're hearing my voice the next day, along with our interview with Scott, obviously this is sensitive material, and I would take it as such, and I would spread this far and wide. Let's give them a heart attack. Scott, what would you like to, what topic would you like to close with tonight? What do you think the people need to know?
Well, I think they really need to be supportive of you, Dave, and your show and your people for having the guts to take this forward. This is an operation. This is a movement and an opportunity for Americans to either take back their country or to get their necks and their hands ready for shackles. And they need to get serious. They need to go to their churches and their communities and their schools and their local places where they live, and take this material, just use my book, for example, as one of the sources that you can actually download and take to a congressman and a senator and say, what do you have to say about this? and I see your name on the letters that were sent. As I said earlier, you can go get letters. You can get letters to the exhibits to Congress, and you can send that to.
Looks like we're getting some interference on your end, too. Scott, are you with us?
Yeah, I got it. They need to take this to their local community and their local groups and start to challenge the forces that are in political power. I had a lady in Colorado contact me and said, Scott, I took your letters and your book, and I went into a town hall meeting, and I challenged my Colorado congressman about it. And that's what every American needs to do. That's if they're serious about their freedoms, if they're serious about their country, if they're serious about giving their kids the stability and the safety of growing up in the Reagan America that we had, then you need to get serious and demand that these old senile men in Washington are thrown out on their ears, are held accountable, are held for potential treason or fired, or new people run for office. And not everyone's corrupt. I certainly am not. I don't care about money. I don't care about jobs. I don't care about friends. I care about the truth and my country and my fellow citizens. I also care about my fellow people who are wearing the uniform, but I care about the United States. And in order to care about the United States, I have to care about the policies that we are exercising all over the globe. And we are recklessly or crazily pursuing this Obama administration military-industrial complex agenda of crushing and destroying all of these cultures and governments all over the Middle East. We're infuriating Russia. We're infuriating China. How in the world can that benefit the United States of America? How can that benefit Americans? Because we have done everything wrong in the past 5 to 10 years, and we've tried to make a sow's ear into a silk purse. Instead, we've taken what we had, which was a silk purse, and we've turned it into a sow's ear. And it's absolutely shameful. But we always have a new dawn, a new renaissance, an opportunity to ask for forgiveness and change our ways and get our country back on the right step. But it has to be organic. It has to come from the people up, because the upward staff, the top congressmen and senators, they're already bought out. They've shown their colors. I'm living proof. I've got the written record. I've got Dianne Feinstein, Mike Rogers, Buck McKeon, Peter King. All of these old people in Congress have not done a single thing about the biggest issue, I think, in the past decade, and that is Swiss banks funding terrorism through CIA accounts. And the Swiss banker who brought all this was covered up and imprisoned. And then the military officer who met the Swiss banker, who also brought it forth, was also imprisoned and covered it up. And then Snowden went and revealed a lot of this. And Assange has revealed a lot of this in the WikiLeaks cables. And it's still being covered up. Only the American people can lance that boil and make it public.
For those of us that are taking notes, let's talk about that Swiss banker again, who funded the CIA to terrorism action accounts. What was his name again?
His name was Brad Birkenfeld. And in fact, I'll give you his email right now. It's, give me one second. It's bbirkenfeld@hotmail.com.
How do you spell Birkenfeld?
BIRKENFELD. bbirkenfeld@hotmail.com. And he is speaking at a Florida conference Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. And everyone should also, if you really want to get in the fight, here's one little beachhead you can invade. There's a conference going on, and there's a guy who's running the conference who's refusing to bring up any of this issue. He's refusing to let me talk. And his name is Dave Merchant. And his email is M as in Mary, A as in apple, R as in rock, C as in cat, H as in happy, A as in alpha, N as in Nancy, T as in Tom, @offshorealert.com. So email Birkenfeld, B Birkenfeld, and email Dave Merchant, MARCHANT, at offshorealert.com and express what you think. Express if you have a curiosity about this.
He needs to stop censoring. How long did Birkenfeld serve to cover this up?
He served for 2.5 years. He was put in prison, and he served 2.5 years, and then he met me the last 7-8 months before he got out, and that's when we put all this together. And we sat down and looked at every cable, every bank account, every document that he had, which I've all put up in the book, Shell Game. And he and I put a letter together to General James Mattis, which exposed all this and demanded a briefing, demanded a Senate hearing, and demanded to go back in front and expose all this.
And so he knew he was receiving CIA money that was going to terrorists.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's the only conclusion you can make. I've been told, you know, he's been bought off, he's been threatened. They've said, look, we'll pay you $104 million in gold, or we'll pay it to you in lead. Take your choice. For me, I would have said, bring it on. If you're going to try and take me out, I'm going to go down fighting. I would not have surrendered my soul. And the time, you know, we're still seeing where it'll go. But he was paid off $104 million on September 11th, 2012, the same day as Benghazi. So the same day that Benghazi occurred, they paid Birkenfeld $104 million. That was not coincidence. That was designed. And I also have that on my website on the video section.
Who took his place? Do you know who took Birkenfeld's place and who's dealing with ISIS?
You know, I don't know. There's a few Swiss bankers who have been brought into the prosecution crosshairs. Raoul Weil, W-E-I-L, but he was acquitted. And there was a there's another guy, but they were called out, but they're going to be brought back into the court system that I will be bringing, because I'm bringing half, you know, all their stories and their documents as part of my defense that I was prosecuted because I was pursuing intelligence related to this terrorist financing, and Dove Zakheim was part of it, and they covered it up and prosecuted me to keep this covered up. None of this was known at the time. It's taken 2 years for it to be put together and get back in front of the court. And that's the other thing. If no one really believes how this could happen, you've never seen the inside of the Federal Justice Department and the prisons that they put people in. You have no idea how bad these places are.
Oh, we know about it. Annie and I know all about it through our friend Alex, which some night we'll talk about.
Yeah. I mean, it astounds me. I never thought the country was this bad until I experienced that. I mean, men dying, losing their legs, no dental care, guys dying of heart attacks, besides all the false prosecutions and lies and backslidings. I mean, they threw Birkenfeld in after he told them, under a grant of immunity, intelligence material. And then they prosecuted him with that very material. That's how disgraceful these powers are in the Department of Justice. And all that is going to come out.
My God, this is... we got more than we bargained for. Do you know when ISIS had its inception? When they first burst on the scene? Do you have any idea?
I think it's had all sorts of different names. I mean, we saw it up close and personal when I was still in the State Department Special Operations Command. That's why I think it's a complete joke when they're trying to label it as a brand new organization. It's not. It's been
It's a hybrid.
Yeah, it is. It's a hybrid. It's a hydra, because you've got, you know, all these Wahhabist contractor guys who were calling themselves different names at different times, but they've all been on the pay scale. They've all been given the intelligence, given the armaments. I mean, McCain, my God, if there's one guy who should be charged as Benedict Arnold, it's John McCain.
That's how I got my start in radio, and I won't go into it here, but he and his fellow compadres tried to steal my home and that of my neighbors without compensation. I live in Arizona, so we all too well know about John McCain. Hey, we're out of time, so very quickly here, in about 15 seconds, give out your website address and the name of your book again.
It's Shell Game by Scott Bennett, and the website's www.armypsyop.wix.com/Scott Bennett. So
okay,
Google's
very good.
Shell Game Scott Bennett. Thank you so much.
Scott, we're out of time. This has been wonderful. You hit a million home runs. We're going to have you back. Good luck with the book and kick some backside in court. Thanks so much, Scott.
Thank you, Dave.
And thank you for your service. Okay, folks, we'll be back for hour number three. Stay on those phones, and we'll see you on the other side of these messages.
On Facebook, on the news, and in conversations with friends, we're bombarded every day with advice on how to be healthier, from gluten-free and non-GMO diets to how much exercise and sleep the body needs. But how much have you heard about alkalizing the body? AlkaVision Plasma pH Drops are a holistic and natural way to get your body's pH levels back in balance. Just a few drops in water will help your body rid itself of harmful waste, and even the healthiest of diets can be complemented with your daily use of AlkaVision Plasma pH Drops. Who isn't looking for more vibrance, vigor, and energy? Now buy two bottles of AlkaVision Plasma pH Drops and get $10 off your order. Visit AlkaVision.com or call 800-518-7615. AlkaVision Plasma pH Drops are packed with a powerful combination of the most alkaline minerals and compounds. Open the door to greater health, vitality, and zest for life. Alkalize your body. Supercharge your health. Call 800-518-7615 or head to AlkaVision.com.